segregated system of federal prisons for non-citizens, segregated on the basis of citizenship, where people are suffering incredible kinds of medical neglect.
Seth Fried-Welsler, we're going to do part two after this interview and post it at democracynow.org. Seth Fried-Welsler is a reporter with the Investigative Fund. His news story for The Nation magazine, "This Man Will Almost Certainly Die." We will link to it at democracynow.org. And that does it for our broadcast. We have several job openings. Check our website at democracynow.org. Democracy Now! Is produced by Mike Burke, Renee Feltz, Dina Guzder, Nermeen Sheikh. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez. Thanks for joining us.
You were listening to KBOO Portland. Coming up next, we have KBOO Evening News, followed by Preference Radio at 6 and Hard Knock Radio at 7.
KBOO Community Radio is a proud co-sponsor of Winter Folk 28, a celebration of music, community, and service on February 20th from 7 to 10 p.m. at the Aladdin Theater in Portland. Winterfolk, an annual benefit for Sisters of the Road, will feature singer-songwriter, author, and social activist David Roth, headlining along with performers Casey Neal, Sky in the Road, Dan Weber, and Kelly Bosworth. Again, that's Winterfolk 28 on February 20th from 7 to 10 p.m. at the Aladdin Theater, 3017 Southeast Milwaukee Avenue in Portland. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
KBOO Community Radio is a proud sponsor of the We Real Cool film series at the Clinton Street Theater. The film this month is A Streetcar Named Desire, showing Thursday, February 18th at 7 p.m. Winner of 5 Academy Awards and considered the first dramatic jazz score of a film, 1951's A Streetcar Named Desire remains a landmark which forced the medium into a new, raw, emotional, mature kind of expression. Again, that's A Streetcar Named Desire, Thursday, February 18th, 7 p.m. at the Clinton Street Theater, 2522 Southeast Clinton Street in Portland. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
And now, your daily volunteer-produced community newscast, the KBOO Evening News.
Coming up on the KBOO Evening News, Portland Mayor Charlie Hale's staff yesterday announced a new plan to address the number of people camping out in the streets.
In New York, Governor Andrew Cuomo asks the Nuclear Regulatory Commission to investigate a leak of radioactive tritium at Indian Point. We'll hear from a member of a group resisting a natural gas pipeline set to be buried near the nuclear facility.
And voting begins in New Hampshire with the first primary to decide Republican and Democratic candidates for president. Good evening. This is the KBOO Evening News for Tuesday, February 9th, 2016. I'm Jenna.
And I'm Jared Dantzler. The first national primary contest is wrapping up in New Hampshire today. Both Democratic and Republican candidates face off for the hearts of New Hampshire voters. On the Democratic side, Senator Bernie Sanders leads Hillary Clinton nearly 30 percentage points. On the Republican side, Ted Cruz, John Kasich, and Donald Trump are in a dead heat. The polls will close by 7 p.m. Pacific time. We'll have results from the New Hampshire primaries on tomorrow's newscast.
Portland Mayor Charlie Hale's staff yesterday presented a new plan to address the city's housing crisis. During a work session at City Hall, Chief of Staff Joshua Alpert outlined the mayor's proposed new plan. Firstly, overnight sleeping on sidewalks will be allowed for the first time except in parks, but tents will not be allowed on the sidewalk. Tents will only be allowed in designated areas from 9 p.m. to 7 a.m. Secondly, Alpert said the mayor will propose a system by which the city will sanction organized campsites linked to a nonprofit service provider. These campsites might have disaster relief pods for sleeping in. Alpert said neighborhood associations might help select the sites. Thirdly, the city will allow car and camper parking on designated properties. Each designated car camping property must also be affiliated with a nonprofit service provider. And lastly, the city will create more temporary shelter space. While Alpert indicated yesterday that the plan will move forward, it is unclear what the timeline will be. He indicated that some of the emergency plan might be proposed as policy in the future.
Today, the White House releases its 2017 budget proposal. President Obama has called the proposal a roadmap to a future that embodies America's values and aspirations. The near 5% increase in spending calls for $4.15 trillion to go towards Social Security, cybersecurity, and interest payments on the national debt. Last year, hundreds of riders were attached to the must-pass spending legislation. Some fear the threat of attached riders to the bill, which could impede on social programs concerning civil rights. For more about this, we talked with Lisa Gilbert of Public Citizen. She began by explaining the work of Public Citizen.
Definitely. Well, I work for Public Citizen. We're a multi-issue nonprofit. We've members all over the country, and we work on a host of consumer and financial and environmental issues. And our concerns generally about the budget process is that it is often hijacked by ideological policy provisions being attached as riders, quote-unquote riders is what they call them. We tried to get out ahead of the release of of the budget process starting to make really clear that we think any eventual budget package should be free of policy provisions that can't be passed the regular way through the regular congressional process. They shouldn't be inappropriately stuck onto a budget package instead.
What kind of riders have we seen in the past on budgets?
Absolutely. So last year in the FY16 budget process, we saw hundreds of policy riders proposed by the Republicans, and really everything from undermining our campaign finance laws by making it harder for agencies to require disclosure of dark political spending to undermining our health and safety regulations, for example, making it hard to finalize a regulation that would make it challenging for construction workers as they try to avoid toxic chemicals like silica, things like undermining the Dodd-Frank Act, which is what was put into place after the Wall Street crash. Really, the list is unfortunately endless, and one of the things that we find most abhorrent about the attachment of these riders is that they couldn't pass the regular order. The only way that those folks proposing them can get them passed is to stick them onto a must-pass bill like the budget.
Could you talk about Citizens United and how, in the context of election, this being an election year, how this affects public elections, general elections?
Sure. Well, so, the budget that was released today is just the president's budget proposal. So it's a resolution where he puts out what he thinks should be in an ideal budget. We'll soon see a similar resolution come out of the Republican House. We're not sure yet if we'll see one come out of the Senate. But soon after that, the subcommittees will start passing their own bills, which are actually the funding bills. When we get to that point, that's when we'll start seeing the policy riders being attached. Lots of things, nefarious activities and riders could be attached. Certainly, we're concerned about any policy provisions that would make the system of campaign finance worse. As you said, the Citizens United decision was one of the things that definitely did that. What it did was unleash unfettered corporate political spending into our system. And since Citizens United, we've seen the rise of super PACs. We've seen coordination limits become more and more meaningless, and we've seen more and more dark money. What we're worried about are policy provisions that make the system worse or make it harder for us to fight for the solutions that we see to Citizens United.
And finally, where can people go for more information, and what do people need to know regarding the president's budget proposal and steps moving forward?
Yeah, I mean, the president's proposal, which, you know, again, we didn't get into much detail, but it's a very strong one. You know, to find out more about it, they've actually put fact sheets and the whole text of it up on the White House website, so just whitehouse.gov, and you can find out all the details. And then to see more about what Public Citizen is doing as we work for a clean budget package at the end of the day, you can just go to our website, which is just citizen.org.
Thank you so much, Lisa, for speaking with me.
Sure, absolutely. Thanks.
For KBOO News, I'm Jared Dantzler.
This morning, the White House announced that it plans to pour $19 billion into cybersecurity in the fiscal year of 2017. The Obama administration's budget proposal builds on previous initiatives and includes provisions to invest $62 million in cybersecurity jobs and over $3 billion in improving the government's lagging and encumbered IT infrastructure. The proposal also lays the groundwork for the creation of two new cyber federal entities and a senior-level information security officer position. The budget proposal, which is 35% larger than last year's funds earmarked for cybersecurity, is also likely to face stiff resistance in the Republican-dominated Congress before it is signed into effect. House Speaker Paul Ryan has already stated that Obama's $4.1 trillion budget proposals for 2017 is a, quote, progressive manual for growing the federal government at the expense of hardworking Americans, end quote. In the face of these sweeping proposals, the federal government faces a long uphill cyber struggle, specifically in the area of public-private sector cooperation and trust. Since the 2013 Edward Snowden revelations of NSA spying, many tech companies have taken into encrypting their data specifically to prevent government intrusions into their affairs. The Obama administration's cybersecurity budget proposal comes on the heels of a large-scale hack of FBI and Department of Homeland Security employee databases made known on Super Bowl Sunday. Protected information of nearly 30,000 government employees was released on Twitter, first on Sunday, then again yesterday. The cyber activist that has claimed responsibility for the breach used the slogan, "Long live Palestine, long live Gaza," and hashtag Free Palestine in the incendiary tweet.
On Friday, February 5th, it was reported that banking conglomerate HSBC reached a $470 million settlement with federal government agencies resulting from mortgage lending and foreclosure practices, which led to the Great Recession. HSBC has been ordered to pay $100 million in damages and to disperse $370 million in relief funds to borrowers and homeowners, especially those currently at risk of default. The agreement also reportedly includes new measures to curtail practices that led to the financial meltdown in 2008. An article published by The Hill on February 3rd claimed that these regulatory reforms will not be sufficient to effectively contain the damage caused by oil train explosions, air pollution, recalls of contaminated food, and other threats to public health. The article cites an August 2015 study published at rstreet.org, which found that federal agencies have missed nearly half their deadline for statutory reform over the last 20 years. President Obama, in his final State of the Union address on January 12th, hailed a thriving private sector as a critical ingredient of a healthy economy. He said, "There are outdated regulations that need to be changed." An article by the Weekly Standard, published 2 days later, criticized Obama's track record on regulatory reform, concluding that the regulatory system remains today largely as it were before Obama took office. According to a new report published in the March 2016 issue of the journal Energy Policy, it found that air pollution caused by energy production is decreasing. According to their analysis, this kind of pollution caused $175 billion in damage across the country in 2002, and only $131 billion in damages in 2011. The reduction is attributed to, quote, more stringent emissions regulations on the energy sector, unquote.
And now from the California Report, the latest installment of our Big Think series comes from Patrice Coulores, Kalors is a co-founder of Black Lives Matter and the director of Truth and Reinvestment at the Ella Baker Center for Human Rights in Oakland. The center just got a $500,000 grant from Google to help make her idea a reality. Her big think? Build a national network of communities to respond to law enforcement violence. Adiza Egan has more.
Given the arrest of four former soldiers Friday night, does it seem to you like a major obstacle has been removed for prosecuting Civil War era crimes?
This is a long process. You know, I think this is a major step in that process, but there is a long way to go. But I think it's spectacular that the Salvadoran government decided the very same day that Coronel Montano was in order to, you know, the order was approved to extradite him to Spain, that the Salvadoran government also moved in the same direction, which I would assume that it might have some connection or some, you know, blessing, you know, from the United States.
You mentioned retired Colonel Inocente Orlando Montano. Can you explain who he is and his connection to the case?
Well, Montano, you know, was a member of what was called La Tandona, the class of military that was ruling during the war. And he himself, you know, would be in charge of a number of massacres that happened during the war. So he was detained in the U.S. for something else. You know, he was lying to an immigration temporary protective status, and that's how he was identified as, you know, somebody related to, you know, these massacres in El Salvador. And after, you know, he served his sentence of 21 months, he was detained, and Spain claimed him. Several months passed, and then last week, finally, you know, the order was issued to extradite him to Spain.
This case in particular, the massacre on the campus of the University of Central America, now spans three countries. Spain, where the legal proceedings are occurring, the U.S., where Montano has been living, and El Salvador, home to the majority of those suspected of carrying out the massacre. Why hasn't the case been prosecuted in El Salvador?
Well, no cases have been, you know, brought to justice in El Salvador. You know, El Salvador has maintained this powerful wall behind amnesty, even though amnesty doesn't apply to cases of crimes against humanity. But no judges or no part of the legal system has been willing to take any case. You know, the case of the Jesuit is just one of many. You know, we have over 264 massacres. Including, you know, the largest massacre in Latin America, El Mozote, where military, you know, has not been, you know, brought to justice. You have the case of the Archbishop, you know, Romero, you know, who is in the process to be canonized, that no investigation has happened in El Salvador. You have the case of the four U.S. church women. And then, you know, the hundreds of disappears and assassinations. The case of the Jesuits itself, you know, is an important one because, you know, this was not, you know, a death squad, you know, which many incidents happened related to the death squad. This was the high command of the military. This was not, you know, three, four soldiers, you know, out of control that went and did the assassination. 400 people were involved. You know. We're hoping the three things happen in these cases of violations of human rights. You know, one is that the truth is known. Two, the justice is made, and then the reparations happen to the victims. So we hope that this will move things forward, not only for this case, but open up for other cases.
Bringing it back to the present day, El Salvador now has one of the highest murder rates in the world, with homicides at a level unseen since the Civil War. There's also been a major exodus of people from El Salvador, citing the violence as a reason for leaving. How does the present day violence connect to the past, and is there a way to work towards a resolution accordingly?
The situation is very complex, but one component, you know, will be the impunity of the 80s, you know, how you go ahead, and in this case, the government, the state, you know, goes ahead and kills, you know, 6 Jesuits and 2 women, and nothing happened to the perpetrators. That impunity is a signal that you can, you know, a young person can, you know, secure a weapon and kill, you know, people in his community, and nothing will happen to them. Then there are other, you know, root causes of immigration, including, you know, these free trade agreements. You know, we need to remember that before the free trade agreement with Mexico, there were only 2 million undocumented in the United States. 10 years after the agreement, over 10 million undocumented. So these policies, these very unfair policies, come and displace people, you know, especially in the countryside. You go to the city, you don't find anything, and then, you know, many attempt to go north. So we need to address also the economic policies, you know, simple things like Walmart coming into El Salvador, you know, and displacing thousands of jobs, or a Coca-Cola coming into a community and capturing all the water of that community and leaving people in with no water. So there are other injustices that go on to promote immigration.
Jose Artiga, anything else you'd like to add?
I would say, you know, let's follow these cases and express our support to, you know, justice. You know, I think that we need to be fair and contribute to the healing, you know, of these cases that have been gone for, in the case of the Jesuits, for 26 years. I have a very personal connection to this case because Elba, the woman that was killed, Elba and Selena, work with my mother. You know, they will come and help in the house. So these were almost, you know, relatives of us that were killed in that November 16th of 1989.
Jose Artiga is the executive director of the Share Foundation. He joined us by phone from Berkeley, California. For FSRN, I'm Shannon Young.
The Oregon State Legislature is poised to consider how best to roll out community solar projects across the state. And that's the subject of a talk tonight hosted by the Southeast Portland neighborhood group, Let's Talk Climate. We're joined live in the studio by Dwayne Fickenstein and Judy Wells. Thanks for being with us.
Thank you. Glad, happy to be here.
First off, we want to ask you, what is community solar?
Well, there are basically three different models of solar power generation. One is the one that you see commonly around Portland on rooftops of private residences. The second is community solar, which are a little bit larger scale projects that are supported by multiple people in the community. They might be located on the top of a public building, a school, a church, something like that, and would benefit folks who can't do their own rooftop solar, either because the roof is shaded or maybe they're a renter or they live in an apartment complex or condominium. So that's community. The third one is the solar farm, which is the big, many acres solar panels that are mostly supported by utilities.
And where does your group Let's Talk Climate come in? What do you do?
We are a group of five people who decided that we wanted to do something about climate change. It's easy to feel pretty depressed and helpless when facing some of the problems associated with climate change. And we thought, we should try to find something that we actually can do that's going to make us feel more hopeful and hopefully make other people feel more hopeful. So we decided that we would put on a monthly series of presentations on issues related to climate change. Tonight's happens to be on community solar. Last month, Bill Bradbury came for our kickoff event. He's a former politician who now is a climate activist all over Oregon and really all over the country. So we had a very big draw for that event, and riding on the heels of that success, we hope that we're going to continue every month, at least through May, to bring issues relating to climate change to the population of Portland.
And talk about tonight's event. What can people expect?
Well, we have two speakers. One is Dan Orzek, who is the general manager of Oregon Clean Power Cooperative. Dan's going to be talking about cooperative solar, where there's an opportunity for members of the community to buy into a project and tell us how that works. The other presenter is James Valdez, who is responsible for policy with Northwest Seed. That's an organization that empowers community-scale energy, clean energy, with technical support, community education, and practical implementation. And James is going to be talking more about some of the policy issues and things that are working their way through the legislature.
And can you talk about what's happening in the Oregon State Legislature a little bit more about this? Why are there initiatives at the state level to make community solar a reality?
I'm not sure I can answer that very specifically. I do know that there's a bill right now in committee. It's a House. It's a Senate bill, which would allow the PUC, the Public Utility Commission, to buy solar generated electricity from community solar installations. So I'm assuming that up until the time that this bill is passed, the PUC is not allowed to buy from community solar. And we do know that there are several community solar installations poised to move forward as soon as this legislation passes, and they can legally do this and know that there will be a market for the power that they're generating. That's a bill that we're following right now. It's SB 1572, and right now it's in committee in the Senate Committee on Business and Transportation. There are two other bills not directly related to community solar, but definitely having to do with clean energy generation. One is in the House. It's HB 4036, which is the coal transition bill. That probably is going to pass in this session. It's got the support of both environmental groups and the power companies. And the other bill is SB 1574, the healthy climate bill. That is much more complex and therefore probably raises more issues for people who might oppose parts of it. And we're a little bit less confident that one's going to pass in this session, but it's not going to go away either.
In your view, looking at these bills and the community work that you do, what do you think are the biggest obstacles to a wider use of solar technology as a strategy to begin minimizing the effects of climate change?
Well, I think one big one are the things that we hope this legislation will overcome, which is are some restrictions from at the state level, legal restrictions on how people can buy into community-based solar. There's also some federal SEC restrictions that apply to the way that community-based solar can be rolled out and sell shares in it. So we're hoping to see some changes in that. The Department of Energy announced this morning a big new project to fund additional both research and projects at the state and regional level to look at some of the blocks to further development of solar, particularly, and some of the soft, if you will, soft problems that relate to its implementation. So not looking at better panels, for example, but looking at the way that the grid interfaces with the solar projects and the way that projects are funded and the way that states and local communities can support solar.
talking a little more about your organization. What else has Let's Talk Climate done?
Well, so far, we've only done one event, which was, as I said, Bill Bradbury speaking in January. We have plans for a monthly event on the second Tuesday of each month at Tabor Space at Belmont and 54th. Tonight's is on community solar. Next month, there will be somebody from the city who's going to speak about the city-county climate action plan with a special focus on implementation. And then we feel committed to do some event both in April and in May as well, but we're not quite sure yet what those are going to be.
Well, we'll be looking forward to see what you guys have coming out.
So we have a short history, but a hopeful future.
Exciting future.
Yeah.
Well, thank you so much, Judy Wells and Duane Fickenstein, for joining us here in the studio. We're going to give that information one more time. The talk is tonight. It's hosted by Let's Talk Climate and co-sponsored by the Oregon Environmental Council and 350 PDX. Their speakers will be Dan Orzek, General Manager of the Oregon Clean Power Cooperative, focusing on solar cooperatives, and James Valdez, Policy Manager for Northwest Seed. Valdez will discuss different models for community solar development, key policy tools, social equity considerations, and the status of current legislation regarding community solar power generation in Oregon. The event is free and open to the public. That's tonight at 7 p.m. at the Tabor Space Copeland Commons at 5441 Southeast Belmont. It's free and donations are accepted. Let's Talk Climate meets at 7 p.m. on the second Tuesday of the month at Tabor Space. To reach them via email, write to climaterenewal@yahoo.com.
You're listening to the KBOO Evening News. Stay tuned after this newscast for an interview with Klamath Riverkeeper Director Conrad Fisher and Klamath Tribal Chairman Don Gentry on the new agreement in principle for Klamath Dam removal. This will be followed by Preference at 6. At 7, it's Hard Knock Radio, news and views from a hip-hop perspective. Tomorrow's weather is overcast with a slight chance of rain. There's a high of 60 and a low of 49. Today in history, on February 9, 1961, President Kennedy asked Congress to approve a health insurance program, the Medicare program, for 14.2 million Americans 65 or older, financed by an increase in Social Security taxes. The quote of the day is from JFK himself, who said, "As we express our gratitude, we must never forget that the highest appreciation is not to utter words, but to live by them."
On Saturday, February 6th, New York Governor Andrew Cuomo reported a serious leak of radioactive water from Indian Point Nuclear Power Plant in Buchanan, New York. Radioactive tritium was found in groundwater testing wells near the plant. This news adds Indian Point facility to the growing list of Northeast nuclear plants investigating leaks. Other plants, also owned by energy giant Entergy, such as Vermont Yankee and New York's Fitzpatrick plants, have reported leaks for years. Governor Cuomo has directed the Nuclear Regulatory Commission to assess the risk to public safety. The governor has not, however, expressed the same concern over a natural gas pipeline project moving forward near the nuclear facility. For more on this, I spoke with a member of an organization resisting the pipeline's construction. Susan Van Dolsen is with SAPE, that's Stop the Algonquin Pipeline Expansion.
This newest hazard, this newest incident that occurred with the tritium in the water, just indicates that we're dealing with an aging plant that has many, many challenges and issues. And in the scope of all these problems, their Spectra Energy was given approval to build a huge 42-inch diameter high-pressure natural gas pipeline with fracked gas coming from Pennsylvania. Pipelines rupture, pipelines explode, and there have been experts since about at least a year and a half ago drawing attention to the danger of putting this pipeline right next to this aging plant with all the problems. And as much as Governor Cuomo has demonstrated huge concern and, you know, wants to shut down the nuclear plant, he has remained silent about this pipeline. And we've been working with, you know, many other elected officials, state level, including Assemblywoman Galef, and had arranged a meeting with Governor Cuomo's staff, and somehow they are still reluctant to make any kind of, you know, statements of concern about the pipeline or requests for an independent risk assessment or a desire to try to put a hold on the construction that's already pretty far along right next to this aging plant. And it's baffling to us.
In the face of environmental outcry and many complaints by the community, the Federal Energy Regulatory Commission has approved the continuing of the Algonquin pipeline. What about moving forward with a federal appeal about FERC's decision?
Yes. So for about 9 months, there was a holding pattern, a tolling order, it's called, which was put into place while FERC was supposedly reviewing all the points that the interveners raised, the residents and communities and municipalities. They were very valid concerns, including this concern about the siting of the pipeline by Indian Point. So during that 9 months, while FERC was examining those rehearing requests, they're called, the pipeline was already beginning to be constructed, and it's fairly far along. Now they've decided to reject these requests for rehearing that were filed, and which means they don't believe that these are concerns that should stop the project. So the only recourse now really is for an appeal of the certificate in federal court. And the biggest problem is FERC basically rubber stamped all projects, and going to court with FERC is necessary to raise these serious issues. However, the time frame is such that the pipeline continues to be built and will probably operate during this time frame as the appeal process is going through. So it's stacked, the deck is stacked so far against the public and the municipalities who really can't put through an injunction. The courts rarely offer, you know, allow that. And the system is basically just not democratic or equitable. The concerns are extremely high about health and safety, and yet the pipeline is being built and while the appeal process is underway.
Will you be able to call for experts of the nuclear community when that federal appeal goes forward?
I'm sure, yes. The appeal will include documents and information from the nuclear experts and the pipeline expert who was hired by the town of Cortland last year to prepare a report that demonstrated this was a serious risk. This pipeline could rupture and cause tremendous damage to the point where it could prevent the plant from properly shutting down.
And finally, Susan, could you give us an update as to the trial of the Montrose 9, the 9 blocked, stopped work on the Algonquin pipeline last year, and their trial is set to continue in March?
So at this point, the case was put on hold till, I think it's March 18th, and there's a review by the judge of venue and some questions that he had. So for the moment, everything is on hold, but they are to return to court in, you know, a little over a month, March 18th. So I guess at that point, we'll see what happens and what the judge says.
I've been speaking with Susan Van Dolsen, member of Stop Algonquin Pipeline Extension. Thank you, Susan, for speaking with me today.
Thank you, Jared.
For KBOO News, I'm Jared Dantzler.
I reached out to Spectra Energy, and they said there will be no impact to the construction of the pipeline because of the leak at Indian Point. Hawaii County Mayor Billy Kanoi has declared a state of emergency to deal with the growing dengue fever outbreak. There have been 250 confirmed cases of dengue fever on the Big Island since October 29th. This is the largest outbreak in the state since the 1940s. No other locally acquired dengue fever cases have been reported on other islands. Dengue fever, which causes flu-like symptoms and can develop into the deadly hemorrhagic fever, is transmitted when people are bit by infected mosquitoes. In the declaration issued on Monday, Mayor Canoy said the state of emergency is needed for additional resources to be provided to reduce mosquito populations. The emergency period is in effect for 60 days and could be extended. Hawaii Governor David Ige said he supports the state of emergency efforts on the Big Island, but would not issue a statewide emergency declaration unless the outbreak spread to other islands or expanded to include other diseases, such as the Zika virus. Zika virus is transmitted to people through bites from mosquitoes of the same species that spread dengue. There have been no local cases of Zika virus in Hawaii, but public health officials are concerned the virus could make its way to the islands. The Hawaii Department of Health has said, while the local outbreak raises concerns, it is still safe to travel to the island.
The public is invited to an open house today from 5 to 9 p.m. at Cleveland High School at 3400 Southeast 26th Avenue to learn more about high levels of cadmium and arsenic pollution near Southeast 22nd Avenue and Powell Boulevard. Multnomah County's Health Department and Portland Public Schools are hosting the meeting. The meeting will be attended by elected officials and staff from Oregon Department of Environmental Quality and Oregon Health Authority. Oregon Department of Environmental Quality is the lead agency for monitoring the concentrations of pollutants and is exploring mitigation efforts with the pollutant sources. Oregon Health Authority is the lead agency for information about health effects, health and medical assessment recommendations, and other health questions. From 5 to 7 p.m., the community can visit agency stations to view maps of affected areas. From 7 to 8 p.m., Multnomah County's Health Department will facilitate a public question and answer period. People will have time to talk individually with government representatives until 9 p.m. For updates on this issue, the community is encouraged to visit the website of Oregon Department of Environmental Quality and Oregon Health Authority. Citizens can also call Oregon Health Authority's hotline 971-673-0185.
The annual Super Bowl broadcast is when advertisers bring out their newest ads, at least since 1984 when Apple introduced itself to the world with an ad based on Orwell's novel 1984. Advertisers promote ideas as well as products. For example, in 2002, the Federal Office of National Drug Control Policy shocked and offended many viewers when they paid for Super Bowl ads accusing pot smokers of supporting terrorists. This year, one of the most shocking and controversial Super Bowl ads only aired in one market. For the second year in a row, the National Council on Alcoholism and Drug Abuse, which is based in St. Louis, Missouri, ran an ad for heroin that aired only in the St. Louis area. Thanks to social media, however, the ad and reactions against it from people in recovery, it has gone viral. To learn more, KBOO reporter Doug McVeigh spoke with Kathy Kane Willis from the Illinois Consortium on Drug Policy.
I didn't watch the Super Bowl. I don't watch the Super Bowl, but on Twitter, there were a lot of confused reactions to the commercial because of, you know, it being sandwiched in between beer commercials and, you know, other kinds of commercials. And Super Bowl commercials are usually, well, they're supposed to be entertaining. But so I think that people were a little taken aback as well, not just by the unrealistic content and the lack of, I think the thing that, the reason why it's become such a big issue is because I think a lot of folks see that the money could have been used, and St. Louis does have a significant heroin problem, it really does. We did a report on Missouri in 2012. On the opiate and heroin crisis. And so it is a problem there. The problem that I think most people found with it was this was an expensive way to communicate a message that is probably not effective at all. And when we look at the literature on PSAs and their effectiveness, we find that they're not effective and sometimes they can be counterproductive. And so I think there was, you know, it was a throwback to, you know, this is your brain on drugs. It felt very 1980s. And I think that since we know what to do, there are very real solutions to combating an opiate and heroin epidemic or crisis in your community. Missouri needs to do those things, and we didn't see necessarily a place to turn for help or to promote those activities. So I think one of the concerns was, you know, naloxone should be included, talking about OD reversal, OD prevention, talking about treatment, methadone, buprenorphine, getting that up to capacity, providing linkages for people to treatment. And I think that a lot of folks thought that the money could have been better spent on things that would actually help the help relieve or reduce the problem in the St. Louis area.
One thing about the commercial has been a lot of reaction from, you know, from the recovery community. I think I saw one reference to the thing as less of an anti-heroin ad and more of a music video marking the resurgence of heroin chic. I mean, as you said earlier, she looked ragged, and yes, she looked strung out, but she also looked like a pretty 17-year-old model. Not just a girl, a pretty 17-year-old model.
A pretty model, yes, absolutely. And I mean, I think also when we're thinking about, you know, interventions or how to get the word out or what effective drug education looks like or any of those things you probably don't want to use a commercial to do that just because of the lack of effectiveness. But I think that a lot of people in recovery were really offended by it because it oversimplifies and somewhat glamorizes it without saying, you know, we do recover. It's stigmatizing in a way of glamorizing it, that the cheerleader is the one who gets addicted. Do you know what I mean? And that's not actually a realistic portrayal of heroin addiction. And I think that while possibly pulling on some heartstrings of parents and such, I don't think that it did very much, except at least from my perspective, to stir up the recovery community to be against the SAD and the perception that this was a waste of money and a lost opportunity to actually do something. Well, I think one of the things that, you know, we want people to address, you know, substance use disorder, and we want people to do things, but we do want people to do things that are thoughtful, and we want them to check. I think people in recovery especially want these kinds of things to be vetted through them too, you know, and to be vetted through young people, and to be